And it's a great pleasure to be here. And thanks for immediately translating what disorder operators mean. It's a sort of unusual nomenclature that I use instead of saying monopoles. Oh, sorry. For reasons that I will explain in a second. So I'm going to be talking about Chern-Simons matter theories. And the unusual thing about my talk, compared to many, many other talks that one might hear, is that I'm going to be completely non-supersymmetric. So, and as it turns out, it's actually possible to do stuff in, even without supersymmetry. And then going back to nice, interesting supersymmetric results will be then a nice challenger slash open question at the end. So let me start by just flashing briefly the introduction. So I'm going to talk about, I'm going to review the basics of Chern-Simons matter theories, and then I'm going to zoom in on the stuff that I did in the last few months, which is to compute the dimensions of an interesting class of non-perturbative solitonic operators in these theories. And so this is going to be this kind of covered in the bulk of the talk. And in particular, I will talk about how the computation of these of monopole dimensions in these theories naturally reduces to studying single eigenvalue excursions in a matrix model, which is a subject that's very familiar to those who have followed old matrix model stories in the 90s. Okay, and then I'm going to wrap up and just talk about some immediate implications of these results. In particular, I will emphasize how sort of 2 weeks after these results were out, they led to a much nicer understanding of bosonization that Ofer Aharoni published. So they're interesting and lead to a very nice coherent story that I'm going to focus on in the end. Okay, so I don't need to talk too much about the virtues of Chern-Simons theory. It's great. It's solvable. It's a very nice three-dimensional theory with miraculous, magical, nice properties. And when coupled to fundamental matter, it's still a very interesting theory. Something that wasn't studied as much as the pure theory, has recently gotten a lot of attention because if you find a conformal point, conformal field theory, which is given by tuning some parameters in Chern-Simons matter, chances are the bulk dual of this point, of this conformal theory, will be some very complicated gravity theory that became famous and then infamous and then famous. Called the Vassiliev theory, which has all fields of higher spin, and which is notoriously difficult to understand, but some progress can be made. So there are in fact a lot of conformal theories that you can build by just taking Chern-Simons, coupling it to some matter in the fundamental representation, and then taking a planar limit, and a lot of them have interesting bulk duals. And as it turns out, a lot of these theories are also solvable in the planar limit. And when I say solvable, I mean non-perturbatively solvable. You can actually solve the Schwinger-Dyson equations to all orders in the Toft coupling. And this results in some really, really nice structures, which I'm going to review now. So are there any questions or complaints about this very introductory stuff? Yeah? Okay, sorry. Okay, so I'm going to focus on theories that are obtained by taking a vector-like CFT in 3D, which has a UN symmetry. So n copies of the free boson or fermion, or n copies of the Wilson-Fischer fixed point, or n copies of the Gross-Novo model. And I'm going to then just gauge the symmetry and add the Chern-Simons term at some level k. And I'm going to work in the planar limit and I'm only going to be working at the leading order in the planar limit. So I'm going to take n and k to infinity at a fixed ratio n over k. And so this is nice. Next, there's this technicality which I really need to mention, which is that this k here is defined using, is not renormalized in this sense when you use this when you use dimensional reduction as a regulator. It's a technical point about how you regulate gluon loops, but it will come back and be important later. So I'm just going to mention it now, and I'm going to mention that if using this regulator, you need to have lambda less than one, less than or equal to one, because otherwise the theory stops being unitary. And this is very interesting, and so that it essentially means that the if you view this construction as sort of, you know, a 3D orbifold, then it means that your orbifold space is actually much smaller than you're used to in, you know, in when you study 2D orbifolds. You can either be at lambda equals zero, which is the orbifold point, where you just have a theory of vector models projected down to their singlet sector, and then you can only move lambda as far as plus minus one. That's and it, as it turns out, when you compute most observables that you can compute in this limit, turn out to be the same as in pure transimus theory. So this is a strong coupling limit where you essentially don't have matter. So,
the thing about this k is really k plus n.
That's a technical point. So if you use a different regularization, if you use, say, Pauli-Villars, you give the gluons mass by coupling a Young-Mills term, then if you couple a Young-Mills term to a transimus with bare level k0, then that k0 gets shifted by gluon loops to k0 plus n. And whereas dimensional reduction immediately works with this object, which is k0 plus n. So you can either think of this as saying, okay, I'm going to work with this regularization and just miraculously, you know, do the math and realize that I need this constraint, or I'm going to start with a nice Young-Mills regulated transimus and with an arbitrary couple level, and then I'll realize that the level gets shifted by n. And in which case, if I use the Young-Mills regularization, then the coupling that's natural is n over k plus n. So this is going to be relevant for a small point I'm going to make later on. Okay. So I'm just going to talk a bit more about the stuff that you can actually compute in these theories and why I'm saying that they have such a nice structure. So as I said, it's possible to compute a lot of things, and this is progress that has only happened in the last, say, 4 years or so, starting in 2011. So, and I'm going to highlight two really interesting things that have been discovered. So one is that there exists a notion of duality, which you can also call 3D bosonization, because the duality maps a bosonic theory to the Gross-Novell model and a regular fermionic theory to the Wilson-Fisher bosonic theory. So the four theories I said like are matched up pairwise. And the connection between a fermionic and bosonic theory, the parameters in these, are given here. So you can see here that it's essentially a strong-way coupling duality, because if you take this to be small, then this is very close to one. And this duality was actually first noticed by studying the bulk duals and noticing that, hey, the regular boson and the Gross-Novell fermion are actually mapping to the same bulk dual. And then later on, this was actually confirmed by doing explicit calculations on the boundary. And I'm going to have much more to say about this later, but for now, it's important. It's good to keep it in the back of one's mind. And then the other really interesting thing that we were able to compute over the years was the phase structure of this theory at finite temperature. So this is the diagram, and at zero temperature, you just don't have anything interesting. And in fact, as I will mention later, these theories have a lot of symmetries, and they protect the dimensions of all the low energy operators. But then as you crank up the temperature, then you start getting interesting effects. And when the temperature is of order root n, so when it's really large, then you actually start seeing these two different phase transitions, which are actually connected in a way that I might discuss either now or later, either at the end of the talk or offline. That these two transitions are both related to the proliferation of non-perturbative operators of the kind that I'm going to talk about. And the names I've given them come from matrix model theory again, because these computations here are often done, especially partition function computations, can be done by reducing the theory at finite temperature to a matrix model. And then in that matrix model, these two transitions are the really old and well-known ones, so the Gross-Witt and Wadia and the Douglas-Kazakov ones that were known from either 40 or 20 years already. Okay, so this is the nice stuff that we have here. And by the way, I should also say that these two transitions map to each other under the duality, which is also an interesting statement. So for instance, one of the ends will go to zero when you're here. So we can talk about the details of this. It's a very interesting structure.
It's not the number of fermions; it's the number of colors.
Yeah.
How many fermions do you put?
One.
One.
Yeah, just one. It's completely trivial to just put an arbitrary number, but it won't really.
Does the blank apply only to the one?
No, it applies to an arbitrary number. It's trivial to extend. In particular, the duality. An easy way to connect the duality to something that's much better known is to just gap out both the bosons and the fermions, and then flow to the level rank duality of pure transimons, which works, and that you can do for any NF, and you'll get the known results for level rank. Another way to do this is to try to break the supersymmetry in Givion Kutasov duality, because this is really a non-supersymmetric Givion Kutasov. And this can be done. I mean, in particular, there's a paper by Minwala and collaborators, which basically use these techniques to prove a version of Givion Kutasov without ever using any supersymmetry arguments. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the spectrum of these theories. So it turns out that there's this higher spin algebra which tightly constrains the form of the spectrum. So your low dimension operators are just higher spin currents. So things that are like of the form psi bar and then a bunch of derivatives and then psi. And to get a nice unitary theory, you actually don't have much leeway. And in particular, the dimensions of these operators are protected. They don't, at any lambda, they're the same. And this is really important. And this determines the structure of the higher spin bulk dual as well. So one can ask, okay, so we know that these single trace operators exist. So what else is there? And there are two types of solitonic operators that you can write down in this theory. So one are the baryons, which you just get by taking n, the number of colors of matter, and then just contracting them with a Levi-Civita tensor. And if you just count the dimensions naively, meaning if you do a perturbative calculation of the dimensions, you'll get that this operator has dimension n. And another kind of operator that you have is...
At a T level or how many loops is that?
I would say at tree level. Yeah. Doing loop corrections to this perturbatively is difficult, because you're essentially then computing end-to-end scattering amplitude, and that, I think, we don't have control over.
It resembles a bit the calculation done for the giant
carriers. That's right, and the connection to that kind of calculation I don't understand yet, but I know this is true, but we were trying to understand how to do this perturbatively and failed, so I'm going to talk a bit more about the baryon calculation later, so we'll see. Okay.
Later or
that's, well, you're at infinite n, so it technically shouldn't matter. And indeed, you can say, well, but hey, at the UN there are no barriers. So what are you talking about?
No, I guess you right. talk about this. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to talk. So this is not going to be relevant for the calculation that I'm going to do. So I'm going to postpone that until the second to last slide, when this was where this is actually understood. But it turns out that barions and monopoles are just facets of the same kind of operators. You really should think of them as one and the same operator in a sense that I will talk about later. But right now I'm just saying, so just looking at the Lagrangian and looking at the field content, these are the kinds of things you can write. So this is something that makes sense in the SUN theory. This is something that should really make sense in all theories, the disorder operators. And I'm calling them disorder because they're sort of analogs to disorder operators in the Ising model and things like that. But these are essentially magnetic monopoles. So you build them by requiring that they create magnetic flux, and then it turns out they also need to create a Fermi sea of matter to dress that magnetic flux and make it gauge invariant. You need k units of matter, where k is the Chern-Simons level. If you do this calculation again at weak coupling, just assuming k is really large, then you find that the energy of the monopole just comes from the Fermi sea of the matter dressing, and the gap in the between the Landau levels there is root k. So then you integrate that root k from 0 to k, and you get this number. This was the naive statement. These are the naive statements that people have gotten sort of hand waving and so on. And so in this talk, I want to understand this precisely and what I mean by disorder operator and so on. Okay, so with this, I'm done with the introduction. So are there any global questions before I start delving into the more technical details?
So both of these belong to some Eigenspin representation?
Very good. I don't know. And my guess is that they're both that you really need to have a central extension of the higher spin algebra in some way to talk about them. And in fact, so either that or you have to just have a bigger group than
the modules for higher spin algebra.
I don't know these things, unfortunately. I think that one of the open topics in the end will be to actually understand this properly as the representations of proper higher spin groups.
These people did compute some tripling functions where you had two monopoles and one.
This was in
fundamental.
This was in the U1 theory with infinite NF.
Techniques for monopole current calculations exist.
That's right. But I think there's a paper by Haroni and Sharma from 6 months ago or so, where they actually say that these kinds of attempts to calculate these things don't work, they were able to just say, well, you can get corrections as large as k factorial by just combinatorics. Without any better symmetry argument. So I think we don't have enough control over those calculations in this case, in the Toft limit. Which is not to say that they're impossible. I think we just need to work harder at them. Already this is something that people thought was impossible to do. So I'm going to say that it's not as impossible. So what do I mean by disorder operators? So let's backtrack a bit. So I mean that these are some operators that are technically present in any 3D gauge theory, such that when you insert them into path integral, they just create a magnetic flux, which you can then detect by the VEV of the field strength. And you label them by the set of GNO charges. One GNO charge for each Cartan element of the group, you can then prove that these charges also have to be quantized. The subtle point here is that only the sum of these GNO charges is topologically protected. This charge will give you then the number of the number of windings if the fundamental group of your gauge group is non-trivial. So there's a priori no reason why all of these operators with arbitrary GNO charges would all be independent. You would assume that only the topological charge will matter. But as it turns out, in general gauge theories, this is the situation is better, and these operators, there are large numbers of these operators with the same topological charge, which are just different, which have different quantum dimensions and so on. And I actually don't know of a good reason why this should be true. Whether there's some other symmetry that protects them or not, I don't know. But for now, I'm just going to say, okay, so a priori, we'll just think of all of these as different operators. And for the ones that for which I can compute the dimensions, I'll indeed find that they're different. So they really should not be mixing.
I mean, when you write a local operator, you don't say these are not protected by topological symmetry. So why is it an operator?
That is also true. So, right. Okay.
Is there any way to estimate the mixing somehow, at least with coupling between different periods of charges?
No. Not as far as I know. So in large NF ordinary QCD, this was done. And there were some very non-trivial patterns. So I was not able to, you know, infer any global rule that could apply to here as well. And like there you had to go to subleading orders in NF to actually find that some of the GNO charges, the monopoles were unstable. So it's not obvious at leading order in N that these are not right things. Okay. So if your theory happens to also be conformal, then you can think of these disorder operators as creating these things which I call monopole states on the two sphere in radial quantization. So these are just states which are some configurations of the gauge field, gauge equivalent to this thing, which have some non-trivial flux piercing the sphere. And so this is the standard Wu-Yang construction. And here we see the dependence of the background on K. So if you just integrate this, the field strength of this thing over the two-sphere, you'll get, over the unit two-sphere, you will get the previous definition of the disorder operator. And so these are the monopole backgrounds I'm going to be talking about.
So what's the action of an instant on which changes Q in its two times R?
So it should be this kind of operators, oh, right, the changes.
So this guy is a state, you're saying.
Well, right. Yeah, so you're asking, now what is an operator which changes it?
Yeah. So these are some classical saddles. So
right. Yeah.
They will be destabilized by instant.
Right. Right. Right.
Flow from one to the.
Right.
I guess one could just try to figure out what the wire is suppressed.
I mean, the instantons should presumably be like just made out of something that annihilates one and creates another. So it's just like two. It's like monopole anti-monopole pairs,
yes.
Essentially, they're the instantons.
Yes,
smooth monopole. Right. Yeah, so I'm not sure I know how to think about them well enough to say, okay, what's the OP of two monopole operators, of two disorder operators, so that I can do something like that.
No, OP, yeah. You're just saying these are two times R.
Right.
You can take this in the past and something different
right.
in the future.
Right, yeah, so.
It will be some semi-classical.
Right, so.
Right.
So at large n, they're all orthogonal. So I think you need to go to the first subleading correction to understand that. That's why I'm saying I can't think of good way.
So maybe the fact that they're independent is just large n.
Yeah. So I'm in large n throughout, yes. Yeah. So.
I mean, but it should be a demonstrable large n.
Perhaps. Yeah, I don't have any intuition for the 1/n corrections because you need large n at maybe 3 or 4 different places in the derivation. So, you know, many people have tried and not gotten very far with the subleading corrections here, I think. Okay, so now we can ask, okay, so at large n, how can we estimate the energies of these objects? And you can try to do it in the usual way. Try to compute a partition function on S1 times S2, and then take the temperature, the size, take the size of the S1 to be really large compared to the S2. That's the zero temperature limit. And then just read off the dimension of your operator. And so doing this is actually difficult. You know, integrating out matter is difficult, even when there are no dynamical gluons. However, the technical developments that I mentioned allow us to compute these partition functions at high temperature, so at small thermal circle compared to the to a sphere, and as it happens, it also turns out that there is an inelasticity argument for which there is some evidence that allows us to connect the lowest temperature phase on that diagram to the actual zero temperature regime. So it turns out that you can actually perform the entire computation at high temperature and read off the dimension at low temperature. And that's sort of one of the miracles of this. And in the end, it's going to be related to the fact that the dimensions of these monopole operators are protected by some symmetry. And in particular, I will argue they are probably already determined by the dimensions of the single trace operators of the higher spin currents. So that's going to be the reason for the analyticity, and I will review the evidence for it as well when we get there. Okay. So, getting more and more technical. So the computation I want to do is just a partition function on S1 times S2, and I just want to turn on this Wu-Yang background for the gauge field, and then just compute fluctuations around it. Just to be clear on the details of what I'm doing, this is the action. It's the usual transimus plus regular fermion. You can also like work with the other fermionic theory, it doesn't matter. I do not know how to do this for bosonic theories, and that bothers me. So I will talk later or offline again on why this is difficult for bosonic theories. But for now, as I said, I'm only working with transimus fermions. So, and these are the conventions. In particular, k greater than n is the something that I already said you need for unitarity. And k is really an integer plus a half, because these things here have a fermion anomaly, have a parity anomaly. So, but since k is large, that doesn't really affect us. And A is anti-Hermitian because of this choice of normalization. Okay. So a big part of the progress that was made recently was realizing that we can actually do a high temperature expansion when we integrate out matter. So essentially, if the temperature is very large, then the matter acquires thermal masses, and then which are also large compared to the curvature of the sphere. So then, essentially, the mass doesn't propagate further than lengths 1 over t. So it's confined to these thermal cells. And so then, essentially, the matter lives in just these, in just little bits of the tangent space. It essentially lives in flat space, and just couples to the high momentum modes of the transimus gauge fields, which just serve to enforce constraints. And so you're essentially, and so for as far as the metric is concerned, you're essentially at flat space with some transimus field and some background. The background comes from both the holonomy along the thermal circle and the monopole flux that I put in. And in particular, I think it's going to be on the next slide or something, but I can choose the magnetic charge of the monopole to be small enough, say order 1, in which case the matter will also not feel the magnetic flux. It will just be very diluted. So for my purposes, I can just integrate out matter as if it were living on flat space and with just some holonomy background in the direction of the thermal circle. So this is a method that was established over the last few years in greater and greater degrees of precision and understanding. And when you integrate out the matter, the only gauge invariant degree of freedom left is the Polyakov loop, is this holonomy along the thermal circle, which is given by this. It's a unitary matrix U. And your entire theory then reduces to a matrix model for this matrix U. And so you have the integral over all the unitaries U. You have some Vandermonde that comes from the gauge fixing. And then you have some the value of the transimal section at this background, at the flux background. And then you have some effective potential for the holonomy that you've gotten by integrating out matter. And this potential, as I said, at large temperature, you only need to care about this bit. These things here are just corrections that look like a curvature over temperature squared and things like that. So these things, at least the first term here, can actually be computed for matter, and I'm going to just show it in a slide or two. Okay. So any questions about this?
I mean, the fact that you can integrate the term, you know, essentially because it's quadratic or in the action,
Well, you also have to integrate the transimons fields that are of that same momentum, and that's for U1, for instance. That's not doable. You can only do it in the planar limit. I mean, it's doable. Well, we don't know how to do it. Yes, it's not tractable at small n.
No, they understand.
Right. We're focusing on precisely these transimons fermion theories because they're essentially all quadratic in the matter. Yeah, if we started putting in, so the Gross-Nervous theory is quartic. So there you need to just add Haber-Sultanovich it back to a quadratic, and then you have two fields, but that you can still integrate out. But six fermion interactions in one of these theories. And in the Gross-Nervous theory, you can also deform it by a 6-point, and then that doesn't change anything. You just keep doing the usual Haber-Sultanovich. But that's all. Like you don't have any other deformations that we look at. Right. Okay. So a few technical remarks on how you get to this matrix model. So to get to the matrix model once you've integrated out matter, you really need to gauge fix in order to integrate out all the non-dynamical degrees of freedom in the transimons theory. And to do that, there's a well understood set of gauge fixings that are very nice and give a very useful form for the matrix model. So basically, the important bit is that you end up diagonalizing the Polyakov loop. So now it's completely specified just by the diagonal values, which are these alphas. So in the end, you end up getting an integral over n eigenvalues of the loop, which is the natural thing to do when you're working with matrix models. And the new thing that you get when you work with a monopole background is that you're now gauge fixing this symmetry where these ni's are just each ni is the number of equal GNO charges in your total vector of GNO charges. So if you have only one non-zero GNO charge, then you're breaking the gauge group to just U1 times UN minus one, and that's it. And so then you will get the Vandermonde determinant for this group for U1 times UN minus one, and this is important because if you just naively keep the original Vandermonde determinant, you will just get zeros everywhere, and that's not the correct thing to do. Another subtle fact, which I'm not going to discuss in detail now because it's going to take an extra 10 minutes, is that. When you go down to this matrix model, you also end up having to discretize the eigenvalues in integer multiples of 2 pi over k, where k is the Cher-Simons coupling. This is a very subtle effect, which essentially means that the density of eigenvalues cannot become infinite. They're fermionic. They have level repulsion. This arises technically as a consequence of this gauge fixing. So that's why I'm not going to get into the technicalities. And I also don't really need this fact, but I just wanted to say that it's a really important thing when you're actually doing the integrals, when you're down to the nitty gritty. Okay, so these are the technical remarks. So let's now focus on this particular simple set of GNO charges. So just take one non-zero GNO charge Q, and everything else is zero. So then, as I said, you just have you're just working with the gauge group U1 times UN minus one, and the Cher-Simons action evaluated on this background turns out to be just this thing. So alpha one is the eigenvalue of the Polyakov loop, which is in the first place, which ends up being coupled to this Q. Oh, and I'm sorry, there is a typo. There should be a Q here, and like here. So the Q, there should be a Q here. And the important thing is that this K0 here is this bare charge that I talked about. It's the one that you get. It's the Cher-Simons level that you should use if you're regulating Cher-Simons by adding a Yang-Mills term. And that's essentially because these monopoles need to be regulated at there so that they're not singular. And the natural regularization for them is the Yang-Mills one. So essentially, but for our practical purposes, it just means that the object, the number that appears in the Cher-Simons section for the monopole is this bare coupling, is this bare level, k minus n. Let's say k is positive, so it's just k minus n. And at almost all values of k, this is irrelevant because k has to be greater than n, and in most cases, it's much greater than n. So only at lambda goes to 1, where k and n become comparable, this is actually important. And if you remember the phase diagram, you'll remember that one phase started touching zero temperature as you crank the coupling up to 1. That phase is actually related to monopoles, and because the monopole mass is going to zero, that the temperature at which that transition happens is going to zero too. Okay. So now we have a nice matrix model to do, and this is fairly straightforward stuff. So all the other eigenvalues, alpha 2 to alpha n, are integrated out in the ways that are in the standard way that has been done in 90% of the papers on this subject. So it just gives you the partition function of the theory at n equal of the free theory with no monopole backgrounds at n minus one, and so you should essentially think about that contribution to the partition function as you have some monopole background, you have some monopole state, and then you have all the possible excitations by single traces on top of it. So these excitations get resummed into this object Z naught, which is the partition function for the U n minus one theory. And then you're left with the integral over the last eigenvalue. And here things become less trivial. So because you now have this contribution from the Cher-Simons action, and you have the contribution that you get from having integrated out the matter. Okay, so now this is an integral that one can do, that even a Mathematica can do. Slowly and with a lot of errors, but you can control it. But the nicest way to do this integral and the cleanest way is to do it by saddle point. So we're in the planar limit, so k naught is large, and we already argued that t squared is large. So let's just say that they scale in the same way, and let's just evaluate this integral using the usual saddle point methods. So and this is the integral we want to do, and I finally put in the potential that you get from integrating out the matter. It's a technical form that some people may recognize from studies of from calculations of partition functions of gauge theories at weak coupling. This is the stuff that that was popular, let's say 10, 15 years ago. So this is what the integral looks like, and if you actually look at this, you will see you can recognize this as the number that you would have gotten if you just started set up a counting problem, where you just assigned some chemical potential to each fermion and you just counted how many ways there are to put in k fermions in on this finite two sphere. So indeed, this integral here over this eigenvalue ends up calculating all the possible ways you can dress the monopole, like you can dress a magnetic flux with matter so as to make it gauge invariant. It's a subtle property of Chern-Simons that if you have a magnetic flux in it, then that operator itself is electrically charged, so that's why you need to dress it. So this is what we would expect from sort of a free theory argument, which is the kind of stuff that that I started with. But this way we've sort of derived this this counting from a completely non-perturbative starting point. So this works at all at off-top couplings. So now, as I said, we can do this integral by saddle point. And then we want to go into the lowest temperature regime at which that saddle point is valid. So essentially we're going to take this kind of double scaling limit. So first we take k0 and t squared to be large, and of the same order, and then we take their ratio to zero. And I will comment on the next slide why this is also sensible. And as it turns out, you get this for the partition function, and so you can read off the dimension of the monopole to be this. Which is good because this actually confirms the naive calculation that was done a few years ago.
So the dimension of the monopole chart 2 looks much bigger than the dimension of the monopole, twice.
Yeah. So that's why they don't add linearly. So.
Does that mean that
your
true monopoles of charge 1
will have? Will not have any monopoles of charge 2?
There are these theorems that people get by like conformal law. I mean, okay. By starting with conformal laws and bootstrap, mm-hmm. all these sort of theorems that say the your true operators. At some point, you find something that looks like operator, some derivatives that are operator whose dimension is more or less the same as some of the dimensions. There must be some interesting interplay here between the number of derivatives.
That's probably true. I don't have any intuition for that, sorry. But I'm going to comment later on what two monopoles together may look like. So, because it's easier to understand how two baryons together will look like, and so based on that, I will argue how I hope the two monopoles together will work. But at large end, this should be the correct answer. In particular, that's why sort of the configuration with two monopoles of charge one, it has a different dimension already at leading end from the monopole of charge two. So 1 1 0 0 0 is also different from 2 0 0 0. Those GNO charges.
Also. I guess that 1 1 0 0 0 will have a dimension which is very close. To
yeah.
Ah, okay, yeah, sorry, yeah. That was my confusion. So yeah. I guess when you do a P or 1 0 0 and 1 0 0 0,
yeah, then
one,
you get
one,
just
one,
yeah,
zero,
yeah, yeah,
zero,
yeah.
Zero.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Good. That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. Now I see why we had like a moment of dissonance. Okay. Good. So now the technical comments on why this makes sense. So first of all, this is a comment I already made that you need to take this only works if, you know, your monopole charge itself is not comparable to n, which is reasonable. And then there's this statement that I have already emphasized several times, that you really expect that the lowest phase, that this double scaling limit captures the t equals zero stuff. So you don't have any corrections from the curvature, even as you dial to the couplings, to the low temperature. And this is a priori not at all obvious, because who knows? I mean, well, who knows what can happen? So first of all, we know that there are no phase transitions below this below temperatures of order root n. So we expect that the lowest phase there is already smoothly connected to the t equals zero regime. And indeed, what has been shown before is that if you just never put in fluxes and compute stuff in the low temperature regime, you will just reproduce the free energy of the t equal to zero theory. And all the Etoft coupling dependence will drop out, signifying that everything you're computing is really protected under changing lambda. So this was checked before, and everything works nicely. And okay, then the next step is that the result we got actually connects to this naive calculation that was done before, just by counting. So that's reassuring. And the third, there is a sort of a posteriori reason why this is confirms this, and that's the fact that with this statement for with this value of the monopole dimensions, we actually now can write down how non-perturbative operators map under the duality, and this was not known before. But now we can get actually a coherent story how they map. So it's no longer like, oh, who knows, it's some large n thing. There's a tight matching, including that prefactor of 2/3 in front of the k to the 3/2, which I've been writing. That prefactor actually matches across the duality in the right way. So I'm slowly winding down. As I said, the dimensions of these operators are protected. It never mattered what lambda we were at. So one can ask, is there a symmetry that protects them? And if so, whether this symmetry is something that's, you know, the higher spin algebra extended in some way. And maybe there is something like that, here's the nugget of lore that we get from thinking about baryons. So if you take two baryons, a baryon and an anti-baryon, then you have these two Levi-Civita symbols, which can then be decomposed, weak contracted, into a product of delta functions, of Kronecker deltas. And then basically, that means that any baryon anti-baryon pair can always be written as some combination of multi-trace operators, like this. So these squiggles here mean that there's a bunch of derivatives here potentially. I can take a baryon which has n size with some derivatives sprinkled in, and these derivatives will then, and this sum will be over different ways these derivatives can be placed into these things. So this is now this is a nice structure, and in fact, this observation was used to argue that these baryons then drive this the first transition, the Gross-Wittenwadia transition, that you can see already at lambda equals zero. Basically, the idea is, okay, so you start counting off the single traces; they're protected under lambda, so you can just do a silly counting problem, and you can write down the free energy. And this will hold all the way up to energies of order n to some power, where there will suddenly be relations between single traces, because then I can now take say two baryon antibaryon pairs, so four of these, and then I have four epsilons, and I have several ways to weak contract them, and this imposes relations between multi-trace operators. And this was actually confirmed just by counting of in UN theories at small n, just that these relations will actually qualitatively affect the behavior of the partition function. So basically, there's going to be a kink in the density of states as you go to high enough energies, and this is going to be reflected by the phase transition in the matrix model. And so now one can ask, okay, so do the monopoles do the same thing? Can I take a monopole and an anti-monopole pair of the same of opposite GNO charges, so +1 and -1 0 0 0 and -1 0 0 0, and can I write those two as some combination of multi-trace operators? I actually don't know how to do this, but this is a natural guess, and if so, then the relations imposed by these kinds of OPEs are the things that drive the other phase transition, which that's again natural, and then since I told you that the two phase transitions are mapped to each other, then you can say, hey, so doesn't that mean that monopoles get mapped to baryons, in a sense? So, but that would mean that, you know, as I said, to have baryons in a theory as standalone operators, you need to have an SUN theory. To have monopoles in a theory, you need to have monopoles with a non-zero topological charge, you need to have a UN theory. For SUN, you cannot have a 1-0-0-0 monopole. That's forbidden. That's not going to be gauge invariant, because the topological charge is going to be zero. So that means that it kind of seems that SUN is going to end up mapping to UN under this duality, and this is something you can already start inferring from large N. Even though, you know, ordinary lore will say that SUN and UN are exactly the same at large N, not quite. So, and in particular, what I said now is actually borne out. If you look at the dimensions of bosonic baryons, you will actually see that their dimensions at weak coupling are exactly 2/3 n to the 3/2. So these are bosonic baryons. These are not the fermionic baryons I was writing. And so bosonic baryons have this dimension n to the 3/2. Because again, you write them by writing, you know, Levi-Civita symbol and n bosons, but then because Levi-Civita would anti-symmetrize these things to death, you need to put in a different number of derivatives in front of each bosonic field, and these derivatives end up adding up and changing the dimension from n to n to the 3/2, with this prefactor for the lowest possible energy, and so this is very suggestive. So now. And in particular, we know that across the duality, the higher spin currents are all dual to each other. So you cannot have a monopole dual to a bunch of higher spin currents. Even if the monopole has zero topological charge, it cannot be dualized to a bunch of currents. So, as it turns out, the spins match. There, it's not a trivial counting, but both have like spins 2 to the n or 2 to the k. Yeah. Or yeah, something like that. So as far as we can do the representation theory for these, all like other quantum numbers match as well.
Stable charge. Suppose you multiple copies of fermions and bosons. I guess that changes the counting.
That shifts one of the k's by nf. But other than that, it should be the same, right?
Now, if I have two pieces of bosons, now I can. I only need n over 2 derivatives.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder if the.
I think this is not known officially. So, yeah, I think Offer has some comments on this in his most recent paper, which is this thing. But I think he.
Now you have a Fermi C with two species. So.
Yeah. NF should map. NF should map to NF. Like the number of flavors should map to. I think should just map to each other. So then you will have a more exotic Fermi C, I think. So, but whether this is completely kosher, I need to check. I don't know yet. But what this has ended up suggesting is that the duality is really sensitive to what UN really means. Meaning, so your un is really something that you can write as a product of sun at some level, with some transimus level, and u1 at some other transimus level. And in fact, like all of these theories will look like un. This modding by zn is just a technical point, so it's not relevant. But
you can do the modding on zn only for some k primes.
Yeah, exactly. So I was about to say, like this k prime has to be an integer multiple of n.
Or
it has to be k plus some integer multiple of n. That's right. That's right. And I think it can be a multiple of k as well. Yes. Yeah. So changing this k prime is this natural SL2Z transformation on 3D gauge theories that Witten discovered. So basically you can, this SUN has a global U1 symmetry which you can gauge with any of these levels. And so then we actually end up getting a statement of many dualities. So we now know that this duality ends up mapping to this. This duality ends up mapping to that, and so on. And this is how level rank duality works as well. These are the kinds of maps you get from level rank. And it turns out that these maps are exactly obeyed by even after you add matter at large n. So this is a very nice structure, and this paper here has come up this month, so the implications are still being thought of. So that's a really nice development that's coming out from this. And so to end, I'm just going to write about some of the open questions that are left. And so first of all, since I like path integrals, I figure that you can also compute baryon dimensions by just turning on a flavor charge, by turning on an explicit chemical potential, and then computing the partition function in the same way and using the same kind of analyticity argument. In fact, this computation at finite chemical potential, I believe you had a talk last Friday on this by Michael Gerasi from Chicago. So Damtan Son and like a bunch of people were studying Fermi liquids in large energy and transimus matter. So they actually did almost the same calculation that I want, except they did it in the highest temperature phase and I want it in the lowest temperature phase. So I went and did it in the lowest temperature phase, and guess what? You actually need 1/n corrections. I was corresponding with Offer about this, and this seems to be the case really, that you actually, to repeat the same spiel for baryons, you actually need to get you need to derive the first 1/n correction or 1/t² correction. So this may be doable now, but
maybe.
I mean, like I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah, but yeah. So that's one thing. Okay. So then the problem with the other natural thing is to repeat the entire spiel for bosons, and then obviously to verify given Kutuzov directly and things like that, because then you would be able to do exact computations with monopoles in the supersymmetric theories. And there we have these interesting papers, these papers 3D from 4D dualities and things like that, where there are indeed examples of some of the monopoles in supersymmetric theories mapping to baryons. And then some other monopoles map to some other monopoles, and depending on which ones are chiral and which ones aren't, etc. So that would be very nice to verify by just doing, not using holomorphy, but just brute force calculating everything. Especially because then we would understand like exactly what all these operators are. The problem there is that bosons cannot be bosons can condense even if you put an infinitesimally small vector magnetic field, they can condense. So this calculation and the VEV of the bosons can be something of order k or 1/k or can screw up your right. Yeah, exactly. So for like this, Selk Kim and a bunch of collaborators have done this for ABJM, and there they obviously found a lot of bosonic VEVs, which they could control there, and I cannot control here. So that's unfortunate, but maybe there's a way out. And that seems like the most natural thing to me. But okay, we'll see if we can do that. And then the next thing is to understand what these objects are in the gravity side. So now that for that I'm not really an expert, because this is now a question of how you embed either brains or like brain-like objects in higher spin gravity. That I don't know, but presumably knowing these dimensions will then help, and knowing that they have these non-trivial scalings with n, will help understand what the energies of brains are in whatever string theory reduces to this higher spin operator, to these higher spin gravities classically. And of course, it would be nice to understand to confirm all the known supersymmetric dualities, something that I've already mentioned, using this direct calculation, and then to see if we can even learn more from them, about them. And so with that, I'm going to finish and open the floor for any other questions that are left over. So thank you for your attention.
I mean, it's not obvious that these models have any interplay with the Huygens-Spring curves, right? In the sense that the dimension goes to infinity when the Huygens-Spring symmetry is unbroken.
True, but at finite n, we know that the baryons do. So let's work in SUN where we have baryons. There you have these explicit relations, which, you know, and there you will just have infinitely many of such relations as you go to SU, as you go to the planar limit. So they will have a mark. So. And so one thing I didn't say is that that I promised I would say is that baryons and monopoles are really the same, because if you have this if you write down un as sun at some level times u1 at some other level, then the only possible non-perturbative operator there is going to be some mixture. You will have add some magnetic flux, then you will add some matter dressing, but you will need to add some monopoles as well, and that's the only thing that can be simultaneously invariant under sun and u1 at the same time. So you will have these, you know, chimeric operators.
Okay, in between. I was going to say exactly about the bosons.
Yes.
The baryons. I mean, somehow you can only talk about them when you have weakly broken, when you have
right.
Started breaking the Huygens curve. So.
Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, basically, otherwise they're infinitely gapped. So, but you need to be careful. Right. Yeah. That's right. But presumably, all of this is actually valid at, you know, and at finite n, so one needs to be, so ideally we can also make statements about finite n, because level rank is exacted, is like correct at any n and k, and so we hope that the duality really will work, and everything will work.
You need to understand at least the one of n correct
right.
to the highest spin
right.
structure.
Right, and so since we already need them for baryons, so basically the reason why we need these one over n corrections for baryon, for the baryon computation is that there you no longer need the order one excursions of a single eigenvalue, but you need to understand the order one over n excursions of all eigenvalues simultaneously. And that's the annoying bit. So presumably, but this should give at least me enough, like, you know, impetus to actually go and try to derive the one over n corrections. As I said, there are like two or three places or four where large n is needed, or large t squared. So maybe by now we have enough technology to actually understand how to correct at least to the next order. It's about time this was possible, I think.
So you had a single fermion throughout.
Yeah.
Calculations, right?
Yes.
What happens when you add more, perhaps any more?
When you add a few more, like order n more, nothing qualitatively changes. You just have some small shifts to the energies, like k gets shifted by k minus nf or something like that, where nf is the number. So at large k and nf order one, it doesn't matter. When nf is much larger than n, when number of flavors is much larger than the number of colors, then this is something that was understood by Pufu, Mezei, and Dyer, who did QCD at arbitrary n, but finite n and infinite nf, and there you have a different structure. Then everything is then all of your monopole dimensions are proportional to nf to some power, and like the n doesn't really matter very much, except like, the n only enters at subleading as a subleading correction. How these two fit together, I don't actually know yet. So like, you know, if nf is of order n, then I don't know exactly how they fit together yet.
Are you studying fluctuations above the Fermi C of the monopole?
Yeah, I think that's what that's the kind of stuff that that, you know, the Chicago group that you guys had a talk on last week did.
I probably missed the talk.
Okay, yeah. So it's online, right? So yeah, it's a nice paper. So yeah, so they find that it's essentially a standard Fermi liquid, except in some regime when it's not.
No, I mean, so, in this context. So is it, what's the next? So you said it's the ground state. This monopole is 2/3 qk.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
What's the gap to the next operator?
It should be one, right? Because it's essentially adding a single, you add a single derivative, right?
There are some very, very surprising things happen. But somehow the small fluctuations of this determinant operator have to match small shape fluctuations of this big equilibrium. And you get some.
So,
I remember there was some unexpected properties of the gap of the small excitation. So looking at the small excitations could tell you a little bit about this object in terms of dual. Is it point like, is it big?
Right, so that would be nice to understand. I mean, so the only thing I know is that if you just study at k much greater than n, so this is the lambda, the free theory, if you study these things there, then you just have, you know, as I said, Landau levels for the fermions, so the gap is just root k in between them. And so I assume that, you know, exciting a single fermion to the next Landau level will just correct this k to the 3/2 by a root k factor. So I think that should be the gap of the first few. This is something that can be also understood by working back from, as I said, this is a counting of certain fermions with certain gaps. So you can understand what exactly the gap has to be. And it's probably going to be root k, and then you can say, okay, so we expect that the next fermion is the next monopole is going to be k to the 3/2 plus root k with some prefactor. So that can be understood, I'm sure.
I wonder if there's any lambda dependence there.
I don't expect it to be. I expect the lambda dependence will only show up as you go to higher temperatures, or to 1/n corrections. But it would be interesting if it did. Yeah, I don't expect it.
Let's thank your speaker again.